Hi, I'm Ivan Semenek. Welcome to The Universe in Mind. This week, a Martian Chronicle. The Phoenix mission to Mars ended months ago, but the science that came out of the mission is just starting to reveal itself. The lead investigator for the mission reflects on what Phoenix did and didn't find, and the new questions it raised. And speaking of questions, is it possible that Phoenix spotted liquid water on Mars? We'll have that story too in this all-Martian edition of our podcast. So stay with us. It's The Universe in Mind, the show that whets your appetite for exploring other worlds. Landing on Mars is never easy, but last May the Phoenix mission sure made it look that way. After touching down on the wind-swept northern plains of Mars, Phoenix got to work characterizing the Martian polar environment and scraping away at the ochre-red soil with its robot arm. Phoenix famously discovered ice on Mars, just where it was expected, a few centimeters below the surface. But not everything went as expected, and scientists are now looking at the data to see what further surprises Phoenix dug up. This week, some of those results are being presented at the annual Lunar and Planetary Science Conference near Houston. A little later in the show, we'll hear from one such result, from a team member with a startling claim about liquid water on Mars. But first, here's a conversation with Peter Smith of the University of Arizona in Tucson. He's the principal investigator of the Phoenix mission. A few weeks ago, I asked him to look back over his Martian experience. Peter Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, you're welcome.
Can you take me back to the end of May in 2008 and that day when Phoenix came down on the surface of Mars? What was going through your mind, and what was it like to get that first signal?
I was trying to maintain a very positive attitude on that day, even though people around me were scared to death. And I show a picture in my slideshow of the administration at NASA and JPL that just looked so worried, and indeed they were. I was trying to keep a very optimistic, positive attitude. I think that's important in life, and there was nothing we could do anyway, so why not just watch and enjoy it? But in fact, I wasn't doing a good job of keeping that positive attitude. I was getting very scared. So as we got close and started tracking through all the various stages of landing on Mars, and there's about five different transitions that are required, it was getting, I don't think I breathed more than twice in the 7 minutes of landing, because it was just too dramatic and so absorbing, you know. Every fiber of my body was with those countdown. They were going from 2,000 meters to 1,000 meters to 800. We knew we were getting close, and is it a huge success or is it a miserable failure? My whole career depended on that, of course. So it was, couldn't have been more exciting, and certainly was such a thrill not only to land safely and to know that, but then to see the first pictures come down.
That's what I'm interested in, too, because after spending so much time anticipating what the landing site would be like, choosing a landing site, trying to maximize the science, how did you feel when you saw that terrain?
Well, I felt wonderful. I mean, we had hoped to land in terrain that was both safe and rock-free, so we have to dig through this stuff, you know, to get down to the ice, so we don't want a lot of rocks. And we wanted polygonal features, and the first picture was just a beautiful depiction of exactly what we hoped to find.
Now, of course, a picture is worth a thousand words, and here we're just restricted to words. Tell me about those polygons. What are they, and what do we know now about how they formed?
Well, when you have an icy surface like we found on Mars, the temperature changes, of course, cause dimensional changes in the ice, and it's going to contract when it gets extremely cold, like in the winter, and it's going to expand in the summer when it's warmer. And so when it contracts, something has to give, and there's cracks forming, and they form depending on the type of ice that's underneath, the depth of the ice, how much soil's mixed with it, whether there's lots of rocks or few rocks. There's a lot of variables, and so you can kind of model what's going on afterwards once you know the size of the cracking. and try and determine just what the properties of the ice below the surface might be. So we were very excited to see not only that the polygons were there, but that some of the cracks were fresh. You could actually see, you know, places that looked very recent.
Now, how would you know that they were fresh?
Well, because they're steep-faced, you know. As erosion takes place, winds coming by, dust devils, whatever, you tend to smooth everything off. So to see a kind of a ledge of soil, that's got to be pretty fresh because it's going to collapse over time.
Now, I guess the polygons would have been your first indirect clue that there is ice under the surface because it's a part of how the polygons form. Tell me more about your direct observation of ice. That was obviously something that was a key science goal of the mission.
Well, there were several things that we saw right away that gave us clues to the ice table. One is when we looked under the lander, unlike the surface around us, which was covered with dry soil, we saw ice exposed by the thrusters. Now, that was down about 5 centimeters. We saw a flat table of ice under the thrusters, and it was pretty clear to everybody that this was the ice we were looking for. But that alone is not a proof. I mean, it could have been a flat rock, it could have been salt, it could have been something else. So then when we dug our trenches, we saw ice immediately, or saw white hard material, I should say, and then we scraped some of that off into little chips, and we watched it sublimate over a course of 2 or 3 days. That was pretty much proof for most of us. Salt and rock are not going to sublimate. And finally, we took samples and put it into the TIGA instrument that has ovens, and these ovens showed a transition at 0 degrees centigrade, and they showed water vapor coming off. So I think there can be no doubt that we have seen an ice, water ice surface.
And I remember you once told me that your mission had the potential to be the first piece of human hardware to actually physically touch water on Mars. So how does it feel to have achieved that goal?
Oh, it feels wonderful. That's the beginning of our mission. Is we really needed to get to an ice table. That's what our mission was based on. And so right away in the first few weeks, we were very confident that we were going to be able to do the science we proposed. And really what we wanted to know was not just that there was ice, because we knew from the orbiter there was lots of ice in the area. We wanted to know if that ice ever melted, because it's liquid water that is the holy grail of Mars exploration. Liquid water because it's conducive to life, and it changes the minerals in the soil. So those two things we're looking for, minerals that were formed through the action of liquid water, and once we could prove that, to see if there is the other ingredients besides liquid water that would make this a habitable zone.
So pushing towards those goals, what have you found so far?
Well, it's quite interesting. We're not all the way through our analysis. There's certainly more to do in the next 4 or 5 months. But already we've seen calcium carbonate and a pH in the soil that's about 8.2 or 3. This is the pH that you would expect, for instance, in a lake or an ocean on Earth with lots of calcium carbonate controlling the alkalinity of the water. So that's, in other words, a buffer. Just like you take Tums to calm the acidity in your stomach, calcium carbonate acts to maintain a pH at about 8.2 or 3. And that's the pH of ocean water, and certainly a very comfortable pH on the Earth for life. We also saw some salts, and at a small amount, not a large amount of salts. And this is about the amount you'd want if you were a microbe. You don't want too many. And we saw energy sources in the form of perchlorate, which microbes on the Earth use perchlorate as an energy source, as a redox couple for gaining energy off of a chemical transaction. So it's all the things you would expect. The real key question is there liquid water?
Now, this area where you landed is not only very far to the north, but it's also a very low-lying area, and others have speculated that this could have been perhaps a large ocean on Mars, or at least an area where water could have drained out and pooled. So is your result about the pH of the ice and the presence of the calcium carbonate, does that suggest that this ice originated as a standing lake or ocean?
Well, we're certainly not prepared to say that. Right now, it seems to be in balance with the atmospheric water. In other words, through snow and frost and just vapor diffusion. Water comes through the soil as a vapor and freezes out when it gets cold enough at about 2 inches below the surface. So that seems very likely to be at least the cause of the ice near the surface. Now, if we dug deeper, would we see a transition into a different type of ice? It's hard for me to answer that question, but I think that may be the case, because in warmer climate periods, the ice is going to go to a deeper level, and you'll have more soil above ice. And under those conditions, when it gets to its deepest level, it may change character. And since we didn't measure that, I can't say for sure, but that may be what's happening.
I think one of the most striking aspects of one of the most striking features of the area that you looked at is how different it is from the equatorial regions where the rovers have been operating and the kind of composition and chemistry that they've been looking at. Could you describe those differences and maybe your thoughts on why they might be so different?
Yeah, the rocks that are seen at Meridiani, for instance, by the Opportunity rover, are formed in an acidic, sulfate-rich, salty environment. It's not the kind of environment you'd particularly expect to find life. It's really too salty, too acidic, and the people on the scientists on the rover team have kind of said this is not really a great environment to find life. Now, what we found was totally the different environment, and so we know now for a fact that Mars has very different types of locations with different types of chemistry. We found an alkaline, calcium carbonate rich. We couldn't even detect any sulfates. That does not mean they're not there. It's just that our instruments weren't able to detect them. And so in this environment, it's a much friendlier environment for prebiotic molecules to form and grow and survive. And it's a friendlier environment for things to grow in. So we think if we can get the liquid water at a warmer climate period, then bingo, we've got a habitable zone.
Now, in addition to the ice, you also were looking at the soil, putting it into ovens, for example. I know that was a challenge, and in a sense, a kind of surprising challenge. Can you tell me about those challenges and what you eventually found from the soil?
Yes, we dug trenches down to the very hard surfaces that we now know are ice, and we used a tool called the rasp, which would send chips of ice into the back of our scoop. And that worked beautifully. We were able to do 16 raspings and got lots of chips, brought them into the scoop, photographed them. We know we had ice. But when we went to pour it into our oven, we had a very crucial timing that was involved. You had to get it in during a period where the oven was expecting that sample. And what happened is this ice apparently, when it was lifted up, got into the sunlight. The sun went right down into the scoop and fused that icy material to the scoop itself. So when you turned it to dump the ice, it didn't dump. It stayed right in the scoop. And so this was totally frustrating. It didn't do any good for it to fall an hour later. It had to go during the time the TIGA experiment was ready for it. So we had a lot of trouble. This happened several times. We tried bringing it up in the shadow and dumping it, and various things came against us. So it was a bit of a surprise and a frustration throughout the entire mission.
I know one of the big surprises on the science side, and certainly this was probably the press briefing that got the most attention after your landing, was this discovery of a chemical called, or molecule called perchlorate in the soil. You mentioned this already. Can you explain what this molecule is and how it comes to be on Mars?
Well, it's perchlorate is chlorine with four oxygens. It makes a radical with a negative charge, so it needs a cation to bond with. We think most likely magnesium is that cation. But when it goes into solution, of course, it breaks apart into magnesium and perchlorate. And perchlorate goes easily into solution, very easily. So it's certainly if it's in the soil, it's going to be in the water that we added to the soil right away. We see a very large amount of perchlorate compared to the other salts. It's 1% of the soil is perchlorate. That's a huge amount. If you had 1% perchlorate in your drinking water, you'd be in real trouble. So it's a lot more than we expected. Now, most people think, and we are still investigating this, so this isn't a final answer, but right now, if you asked me, I'd say it's formed in the atmosphere, and that ozone as part of the process of formation. Ozone being a gas that forms in the polar regions as water is pushed from the polar cap up into the upper atmosphere and photolyzed by the UV. So ozone with chlorine that gets carried up on dust particles can form this perchlorate, and it rains back to the surface.
So how does the presence of that perchlorate, which is a surprise, how did that affect your efforts to investigate what else was in the soil?
Well, we had a tremendous frustration when we put soil into our ovens and looked for organic materials, because at a certain point, perchlorate, as you heat it up, it combusts. All that oxygen breaks away from the chlorine, and you have a very oxygen-rich environment at a high temperature, and anything that can combust will, and organics is one of the things that's easily combusted. So basically, we torched all the organics in our oven, and what was released was carbon dioxide. Unfortunately, we can't claim it's organics because carbonates could do the same thing, and until we do a very detailed laboratory experiment to try and reproduce the exact signals we see on Mars, we cannot separate carbonates and organics. So right now it's a maybe.
Now, I know hindsight is 20/20, but if there was some future effort to go back to this environment, how do you get around that and look for those organics without having the damage of the perchlorate?
Well, I think you'd have to find another method besides just heating the material. After all, perchlorate is what we used in our solid rockets. Ammonium perchlorate is the oxidizer in a solid rocket. As you know, as you're burning rocket fuel and you go up above the oxygen in the atmosphere, you got to substitute it with something else. And so perchlorate, with all its oxygen, is often substituted and for the atmospheric oxygen. So I don't know how you're going to be able to do this if you have perchlorate in the soil, unless you have some other technique that can separate the perchlorate out first. So it's a bit of a challenge here.
I know you also, in addition to all of this focus on what was below the surface, there was one part of the mission that was focused in the opposite direction. This is the meteorology experiment. What were the surprises that came out of that experiment?
Well, the experiment worked beautifully. We had a lot more data than we ever expected. I think the Canadian team was hoping to get one or two observations a day. They were getting five. And they just hoped maybe once in a while to get a nighttime observation. They were getting it every night. So I think there was a tremendous bonus that came from the rigorous way that the spacecraft was designed and tested. And that allowed us to do extra observations, and particularly with weather, which is always ready to be turned on and do something, whereas the arm and the analysis instruments are much more tricky, and you have to spend days preparing. So the weather station worked just night and day throughout the entire time, and we thought we'd see water ice clouds. For the first, I think, 70 to 90 sols, we saw none. Why not? Where are they? And then all of a sudden, when we least expected them, at the end of the mission, when we thought everything would be drying out and would be dusty, it turned around, and then we saw water ice clouds, snow, dust devils, frost on the ground, a very unusual weather condition that was really not expected. And I think once it gets modeled properly and the data is understood, we'll be rewriting the weather report for Martian Arctic. It's really very different data than we thought we'd find.
Now, I know planetary scientists are always thinking about the next mission. In a perfect world, what would you like to do next?
Well, I think we've just literally scratched the surface of the ice in the polar region. I've become a big fan of polar science. I think you can learn an awful lot about a planet from what's stored in the ices in the polar region. I would love to go back to a similar location and with an ice core, and just get an ice core down as deep as that ice can go and look at the history of Mars and the ice. I think we could learn a tremendous amount.
I know the lander went silent in early November, and this was expected because, of course, the sunlight is diminishing. It's going into winter time in the Martian Arctic. What are the prospects that at some point you may regain contact?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. I think the probability is low that we'll get it back, but it's certainly not zero. Now, just Where it is in the low probability range, I couldn't tell you, but I do know that it's going to get extremely cold in Fahrenheit. I believe it's minus 220, and it lasts for month after month at those temperatures. With carbon dioxide ice frozen out of the atmosphere settling onto the lander deck and on the solar panels. Now, can it survive that? I think it's unlikely. I think it was never tested for that. We never expected it to survive. But, of course, it's named the Phoenix Mission, and you never know. It could come back.
So physically, what would be the big, just to elaborate on that, what would be the big challenges? I'm picturing this CO2 ice. I mean, how is that going to be a challenge to the lander?
Well, it's heavy. You get 20 centimeters of ice on the solar panels. It's more weight than they were designed to support, so they could just physically break right off and drop to the ground. Now, as far as electronics, there's no heaters now on the spacecraft, so every electronic board is seeing the same temperature that the rocks are seeing, basically. And there are transitions in those materials in the electronics board where you go below those temperatures, things crack and break. So it'd be a miracle, I think, to have those electronic boards survive those cold temperatures.
What would you say has been the most gratifying thing for you looking back over the mission? There have been so many high points and so much science. What gave you the most satisfaction?
Well, there's a thrill of discovery. We went there expecting an acidic, sulfate-rich environment. We were hoping to find ice. We had no idea how deep it would be, except some vague predictions. And I think the mission just unfolded beautifully from my perspective. We found that was totally different than what we expected. Alkaline with carbonates, this is a huge discovery. I mean, nobody expected this. It was totally unpredicted. Perchlorates, brand new area of Mars science. Now everybody's looking at perchlorates, trying to see how it affects some of the interpretations they've made in the past. So I think, and that with the plus the really important weather record that we have in the northern polar region, which is just beginning to be looked at and modeled, I think that'll change the way we think about certainly the polar region, and because the polar region is so important, it'll affect the way we think about Mars in a very large respect.
Well, Peter Smith, thanks for opening up a whole new region of Mars to all of us, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ivan. It's a pleasure.
In our previous interview, we heard from Peter Smith, principal investigator of the Phoenix mission, recorded before this week's Lunar and Planetary Conference near Houston. Since then, some Phoenix team members have gone public with a remarkable claim. They think Phoenix found not just ice, but liquid water on Mars, although not everyone on the Phoenix science team agrees with their interpretation. Dr. Nilton Reno is the lead author of the new finding. He's a planetary scientist at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and that's where I reached him last week. Hello, Dr. Reno. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Dr. Reno, can you describe the features you saw that suggest to you that water is present on Mars?
Shortly after Phoenix landed, we took some images from under the lander. The main reason that I was interested in the images to check the work of one of my graduate students that work on the simulation of the effect of the Phoenix landing thrusters at the surface of Mars.
Okay, these are the jet thrusters that are blasting the surface of Mars as the lander's coming down.
Yeah, and our experiment here suggested that during the landing process, in less than a second, Phoenix would completely remove the topsoil and expose the ice below the lander.
Right, and that did happen, I think.
It did happen,
and when the image
came, I called my grad students right away and sent the image to him. His name is Manish Mehta, and he was so excited. He couldn't keep screaming, saying, "Oh, my God, oh, my God." And it was, for me, one of the highlights of the mission was that moment.
So that was the ice under the lander, but what about the water?
Yeah, then, so with that images showing the corner, not at very good resolution, those spots, and then we start discussing what were those spots. And I was thinking about all the prediction from the simulation. One of them is that when this plume is impinging at the surface at very high pressure, so the temperature goes up, so maybe the top layer of the ice would melt, and we did the calculation that suggested about a millimeter of the ice would melt and splash around a sort of mud.
Okay.
And then I thought, well, those things were mud, and that was it. But then this was on Sol, I think, around five days after we landed.
Mm-hmm.
And then 8 days after we landed, we took a much, much better image and shows those spheroids very well, and they look what you expect from a liquid substance.
So at first you saw some spots on the leg, then, mm-hmm. and you thought maybe you were looking at a kind of mud splatter.
Yeah, exactly.
But then they changed and darkened, and,
uh-huh.
and they also looked kind of spherical to you.
Yes.
Now, how large would these, if they're droplets of water, how large would they be?
That's very good. So we did a calculation to find out. On Earth, they can be as large as about a centimeter over a flat surface,
mm-hmm.
and less than that in a vertical surface before they drip, right?
Right.
Like we did the calculation for Mars because of the lower gravity and the lower temperature. They can be much larger. They can be up to 3 centimeters in diameter and be stable. In a vertical wall, they can be up to 1 centimeter in diameter and be stable. So then I check, okay, let's see if those things are consistent with what we see. And it is. There's nothing there larger than this.
So based on the temperature and the gravity, it's consistent with these things being drops of water clinging to the lander.
Exactly.
Now, how could water survive in those conditions? Isn't it too cold and too dry?
Yeah, that's a very good question. This is a highly saline water. As you add more and more salt to the water, the freezing point becomes lower and lower. If you have water with table salt, the one that we use in our food, that can lower the freezing point of water by about 23 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
And then some of the salts that we found on Mars at the Phoenix landing site can lower the freezing point down to about 75 degrees Celsius. So the freezing temperature of a highly saline water with perchlorate of calcium or magnesium on Mars would be lower than minus 70 degrees Celsius.
I see. So other experiments found evidence for perchlorate in the soil of Mars.
Exactly.
And you're saying that perchlorate comes from a salt that would be...
Well, the perchlorate is a salt.
It's a salt. So and it it keeps this this water in a liquid state, even
exactly.
at the low temperatures.
Even at the lowest temperature that we measured there at the beginning of the mission.
So where do you think this water came from? I mean, is it widespread around the landing site, or is it just something that was created when Phoenix landed?
Well, the water was absorbed from the atmosphere because we see the spheroids growing as a function of time. So the south was splashed during the landing. But initially, the south was relatively dry. Some of the place where we see is just a dark spot, and those particles grew there. So the water is coming from the air itself.
And do you think that this is a widespread phenomenon? Could there be water droplets all
I
over?
I do. And I just thinking about the thermodynamics, you expect this to form almost everywhere if the two conditions are met. There is those powerful antifreeze or salts, like perchlorate or could be any other salt, and if there is a source of water. And in this case, in the polar region, was the source of water was the atmosphere. And if this layer is just below the surface, that's not directly exposed to solar radiation, and it's sort of buffered from the diurnal temperature fluctuation, like this region under the lander that's buffered because it's in the shadow of the lander itself, then those small pockets of liquid water can form.
Well, Dr. Reno, I noticed that NASA is not bending over backwards to announce to the world that water has been discovered on Mars. And
uh-huh.
I'm wondering what other scientists on the Phoenix mission are saying about your find.
Well, I have 22 co-authors in the paper, some of the experts on astrobiology, like Chris McKay, some of the really senior people in the mission, like the principal investigator, Pete Smith. So there is a little bit of controversy, but the controversy is nothing like what we have seen in the media.
What do you think it will take to be sure that this is water?
Okay. There are two things. I follow up with lab experiments, and the results of those lab experiments, that's totally consistent with what we see there, including this change in the darkness of the spot. And I think after that, I think it's a really convincing case. And maybe another thing, we need another set of independent measurements. So another one of the next missions to Mars have an independent set of measurements.
And do you think that next mission would have to go to the polar regions to see the effect?
Those things could happen maybe in crater walls, in shadows behind a big boulder. So there are other places that it could happen. All that you need is the south and the source of water there.
You know, Dr. Reno, there's a long history of controversial claims about Mars. I'm sure you're familiar with them. Of course, the Viking landers have a controversial claim associated with them about as to whether or not there were signs of life.
Yeah.
Also, there's the well-known meteorite that a team
life.
Claims has some signs of life. I know you're not talking about life. You're just talking about salt water.
Yeah.
But do you feel like you're being sucked into one of these
controversies? I don't think so, because this is the most logical explanation. We know that you have salt and you have a source of water. That salt is going to absorb water. You know, if that water is, you have a very saline solution, it's going to be liquid at temperatures that we found there. So if you just remove all the arguments and everything, I think this is the most logical explanation.
Well, Dr. Reno, it's a very exciting and very intriguing finding. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Dr. Nilton Reno is a professor in the Department of Atmospheric, Oceanic, and Space Sciences at the University of Michigan. Now, if you want to look at some of the images that Dr. Reno says show water droplets on the Phoenix lander, you can find them on my blog at di.utoronto.ca/journalist. Feel free to make a comment and let us know what you think about whether there really could be liquid water on Mars. And that's it for this episode of The Universe in Mind. Remember, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes. The Universe in Mind is brought to you by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Toronto. Kathy Parrott is our online producer. Our cover art is by Bettina Forget, with graphics by Efahan Albi. I'm Ivan Semenik. Be sure to check in with me next week for more news and conversations about the world of astronomy. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind. Thanks.